Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
When we started this podcast back in January, our intention was to record a series of conversations between Kay and myself every time we could meet and occasionally invite a guest or stream a recorded conference panel discussion. Between us, we would discuss what had happened in a week, place privacy and data protection developments around the world in context, and provide insights based on our own experience. And then Corona happened. The podcast became popular much faster than we could ever have hoped for, and suddenly guests were with us almost every week. And for this week, we had also recorded an episode with a guest. But so much has happened in recent days that we decided to just have the one-on-one conversation this week and really discuss the week that was. You will hear about new EDPB guidance, next steps in the Schrems case, and the fallout from the Privacy Shield annulment, as well as on the latest developments from Brazil. Next week, we'll be back with a guest, promised. And as you will have guessed by now, my name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I'm with Paul. I'm very, very excited about just having a catch-up on privacy news between he and I. But I'm pulling up the unexpected question, which, as y'all may know, which is actually unexpected to me as well. Oh, actually, this takes me back. I just came across, how would you describe your victory dance?
A Fortnite dance.
Okay, here's a good one. What expression do you overuse?
Can I answer that one for you?
I think all of our listeners know what expression I overuse.
Well, probably in a privacy context, I would say my favorite expression would be "it depends." Because privacy law is never black and white. And as I tell my students, if they ask me if I can give any insights into the exam, I said, sure, I'm happy to provide you with all the answers. It's A, B, C, D. And for the open questions, yes, no, but mainly it depends.
Exactly.
And the rest you'll have to figure out yourself. So it depends.
I like that. Well, shall I respond and say that my favorite phrase then is, it depends on the context. No, no, actually, for our podcast, it tends to be, you know, that's fascinating, or I love that, which is true, which I tend
right.
to use those a lot in a personal context as well, because I like people to know that my immediate response to what they're saying is positive. And so it's not a filler word. It's not something I use to give myself time to think. I just like to compliment first. So if you ever hear someone tell me something and I don't respond with something positive first, and I just,
then you're in trouble.
Then it's like, ew, I didn't like what they said at all. It's kind of like asking me for a reference on someone. Since I know a lot of people in the Phoenix area, a lot of, you know, people will come to me informally and ask for references about students. And if I tell them, oh, they're nice, I like them, they're a great student, they're like, oh, you don't like them.
It's just nice.
Because apparently, if I like someone, I'm like, oh, yes, you're going to love Paul. He's absolutely amazing. So it's that investment of energy in the answer that is probably more important than the other. But I know we have some really cool privacy topics to start with today. What would you like to...
Let's start with the latest news. Let's start with the Wall Street Journal.
I love it. So the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, I believe, decided it was just this week. Was it yesterday or the day before?
It was this week. It was on Wednesday. It was published by the Wall Street Journal.
Okay, perfect.
So September 9th.
So the Irish Data Protection Commissioner has asked Facebook to stop transferring personal data from the European Union to the U.S. And that's pretty significant. Apparently, there was a preliminary order sent in late August. And this came out, as you said, from the Wall Street Journal. And then Facebook has confirmed that the Irish Data Protection Commissioner has started investigating and launching an inquiry into their practices. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a big step forward. This is decisive action. It's also doing what the court said that they should do, because in the Schrems II decision, the court made very clear that it is up to the data protection authorities to maintain the law, and they have a duty to enforce. So that is something that the Irish DPC apparently is now doing. Indeed, it is just a preliminary order, so Facebook has a month to respond. And then the final decision that the Irish DPC will take will have to go through the European Data Protection Board before it becomes final.
But this will move faster than a lot of European decisions, right?
It is likely that this will move faster. So it is expected that we may have a final decision by the end of the year. So as one of my contacts already said yesterday on Twitter, Christmas is cancelled as well, like we had any expectations for Christmas in 2020 left, but probably we'll see it indeed in the final week before Christmas or something like that. We'll get this final decision on the data transfers by Facebook.
I'm hoping the best gift we all have for Christmas is that 2020 is over.
Yes, and maybe a vaccine. That would also be nice under the tree.
Yeah, that would be nice. So what I find really interesting about this decision is this is something that privacy officers and consultants have been telling companies for years. When they look at the potential penalty under the GDPR, it's like you do realize the penalty may not be the worst thing. The worst thing is they could stop you from doing business in Europe. They could stop the data transfers. Mm-hmm. And companies just look at me like I'm speaking, you know, well, not the companies, people in the companies, look at me like I'm speaking a foreign language that they don't understand that Europe can stop them from doing business. And so this is a huge step forward. And one of the quotes or one of the information that I saw, and this was in the article, it was what Nick Clegg said. He's their VP of Global Affairs and Communications.
Former Deputy Prime Minister of the UK.
Yes. He is saying that a lack of safe, secure, and legal international data transfers would damage the economy and hamper the growth of data-driven businesses in the EU, just as we seek to recover from COVID. The effects would reach beyond the business world and could impact critical public services such as health and education. Mm-hmm. Now, my thought on that is someone is reaching for a public policy decision to oppose this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a bit scaremongering from Facebook. And we'll post to the broader Facebook statement in the show notes. But what they've done basically is written a long blog on why all of this is complicated and dangerous and why we should be careful. And of course, that they will comply with the law.
Now, do you believe that the populace of Europe will be upset at not being able to have a Facebook? Or will they have a Facebook, it just won't come to the U.S., it will only go to the European data center with no access from people in the U.S.?
I think it will be the latter. I mean, it has been clear for quite some time that at some point there will be a decision, especially for large tech companies, that data flows, continuous data flows to the U.S., unless there are changes on the surveillance laws in the U.S., that there will be limitations on what is possible. So I would be very surprised if Facebook engineers and the same for other tech companies have not come up already with some form of backup plan that will maybe be a bit more clunky than they would like their software to work, but that is still an option. Whether that can be implemented overnight, I don't know. Probably there will be some time between the announcement of the decision and the information given to the company that it's coming, so that they may be having a few days to prepare. But we'll see what happens there. What is also clear from this case, and that is basically coming from letters that have been published by Max Schrems himself, in conversations with Facebook and with the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, is that this is about a separate case. This is not the enforcement following the Tremsu decision. The Irish DPC has launched a separate investigation into these data transfers that has resulted in the preliminary compliance order that the Wall Street Journal cited on. But that is a bit strange, I believe, because the Schrems II case or the Schrems cases have been running for so long, and also the Irish High Court in the past already said this should end sooner rather than later. And to suddenly have a separate case where the enforcement would take place and where the result would be similar to what Mr. Schrems is trying to achieve, it is still strange in my view that it would be in a separate case instead of a decision in something that has been going on so long.
Right. I agree. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. Do you use Facebook?
I have an account. However, I do use two of their other services. I do use Instagram. I do use WhatsApp. So
I don't use WhatsApp. I don't know why. I don't trust it. What's up with WhatsApp?
Well, like it's ubiquitous in conversations with friends and family. And even though I try to get as many conversations to Signal as possible, it's not easy to get that done. So yeah, WhatsApp is still around here in Europe and very popular. So
it's used heavily in South America as well.
I'm not out of the scope of any Facebook data decisions that may or may not happen. But while we are talking on Schrems II, maybe also good to remark that last week, so that would be on September 3rd, there was a hearing in the European Parliament in follow-up to the court's decision with the chair of the European Data Protection Board, Andrea Jelinek, with Max Schrems on behalf of None of Your Business, his NGO, and also with European Commissioner DJ Reinders, who is responsible for justice and thus also for data protection. I've written a blog on the hearing on the TrustArc website that people can read. But what is interesting is that it came up in the hearing time and again that there is so much focus now on the US that the message almost seems to get lost, that the court's decision, apart from the part on the privacy shield, was not about the US only. This is about the world. And I don't think that for many companies the message has sunken in already that they don't only need to look at their EU-US data transfers, but at their EU-rest of the world data transfers.
And there are 92 countries with international data transfer requirements.
Yes.
And not all of them are the same.
No, and there are 180-something countries that are not part of the European Economic Area. Some of them with very good privacy laws and very limited surveillance laws, and some of them with an adequacy decision, but most of them not. And for all of those countries, you will need to start assessing if you transfer data from the EU to any of those countries, if your standard contractual clauses or your binding corporate rules or your other transfer mechanisms, for that matter, are still sufficient, yes or no.
Right. And I think it's interesting because there's a lot of countries that have mass government surveillance. Mm-hmm. Outside the U.S., I mean, seriously, do people really believe the U.S. is the only one doing this?
Well, I hope not.
You and I spoke about this in your favorite privacy topic in surveillance.
Absolutely.
So it's really interesting that we covered the government surveillance, and then, you know, within 2 months or so, then this decision comes out, which is interesting. But yeah, in going back and looking at that, so a lot of people understand that the U.S. privacy shield and now the Swiss privacy shield has been invalidated. So if you didn't know, the Swiss privacy shield has been invalidated.
It's gone.
You do. It's gone. Yeah. So, but people automatically think they can turn to standard contractual clauses. And this is very unlike when the safe harbor was invalidated just, you know, what, 3-4 years ago? I guess 4 years ago, it was 2016. That was a decision specifically on the EU-US safe harbor, but it did not address standard mm-hmm. contractual clauses. And so people now are wondering, well, what's different? Why can't we go back and do the same things we did before?
Because the court case was not about the privacy shield in the first place.
Right.
The privacy shield was collateral damage in this case.
Yeah, Exactly. And this court, not only was it collateral damage, but the court specifically addressed standard contractual clauses, saying they, paraphrasing, they can't operate in isolation. You have to look at the other. So if we extrapolate that to the binding corporate rules, and I had this conversation with another privacy professional, they're like, well, why can't we just help companies put binding corporate rules in place? Doesn't quite work that way. You can. But binding corporate rules needs, you can have a privacy consultant absolutely help you operationalize what you need to do for BCRs, whether it's binding self-processor rules or whether it's binding corporate rules. You can absolutely have a privacy consultant help you operationalize it. But in my opinion, you need an attorney to actually help you through the BCR process, mm-hmm. to work with the data protection authorities to do that. But in a, I don't know whether you would call this a more micro view, standard contractual clauses are per contract.
Yes.
Binding corporate rules are per entity.
Per group of entities even.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a different approach. Does that mean for each data transfer, you still need to individually assess the country that the data is going to?
Well, I think what you would be able to do is, as a company or maybe even as a group of companies, do an assessment of the legislation of a third country and refer to that and agree on what you consider to be additional appropriate safeguards for that specific country, or maybe even conclude that they are not required because of the legislation in that specific third country. So I think that is possible, and I would hope that part of the work that the task force that the European Data Protection Board has now created will also be on assessing the most relevant economies for international transfers and come up with recommendations on what safeguards could be put in place for those. Not sure whether they will be able to, but that would be nice. And otherwise, the industry will need to take that upon themselves, because it's insane to believe that every company will have the resources to make such assessments themselves for every single country they would like to do business with. So right. Some sort of standardization will need to take place there. When it comes to binding corporate rules, another important difference is, of course, that they apply intra-group. So they don't apply from company A to company B. It is
right.
an additional safeguard if you transfer your data to a company that has BCRs. But even then, also the BCRs are only a contract, which would not necessarily protect against government interference.
Right. So there are solutions, but of our listeners, raise your hands if you've ever actually read the standard contractual clauses for contractual provisions to where you can abide by them.
And have filled out all the annexes.
Yes, and you've actually added individual information into the annexes. So that's the thing that scares a lot of us, is the fact that companies seem to be putting standard contractual clauses in place just willy-nilly. Mm-hmm. We're just going to sign them. They don't fill out the annexes. But here's the thing. It is both the importer and the exporter that are guilty of this. Nobody likes the standard contractual clauses.
And if they are not filled out, you are not compliant.
It's absolutely crazy to know that there's a solution out there that, one's not commercially friendly, two, actually at this time doesn't comply with the GDPR, three, most companies, importer or exporter, don't actually read them or fill them out completely, and four, they don't actually comply in most cases.
So how many conversations have you had in recent weeks about U.S. companies wanting to do binding standard contractual clauses with another U.S. company?
Oh my gosh. It's absolutely crazy. And to try to get them to, and I can't tell you, I literally can't count them, to try to get them to understand that there is no such thing as processor to processor standard contractual clauses. They don't exist. They're not there.
Yet.
Now, can you put a controller to processor SCCs in place and put additional protections on top of it that state that these also apply to processor and add some additional? Absolutely, you can mm-hmm. do that, because it's still a contract.
Yep.
And so you're still agreeing to certain things, and you're agreeing to a certain level or a certain standard that the European authorities have approved. So it's kind of giving you some assurance that if your data transfers were reviewed and they did look at your what would you call them, modified? You can't modify them exactly, but your use of standard contractual clauses in an unexpected way, sure, that might go far in helping you work with the DPAs that you tried to put some reasonable things in place. But news note, SCCs don't apply to processor by processor. You have to do some extra things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
If you want to use them.
They will get there in the future because the new set...
Now, are they going to get there this year?
Yeah, probably. Probably we'll see the draft by the end of September of the new standard contractual clauses under the GDPR, controller-to-controller, controller-to-processor, processor-to-processor, and maybe even controller-to-government. So that's also something that might be coming. There has at least been some rumor about that. But in any case, processor to processor has been confirmed that a draft is forthcoming.
I'm excited to see these. I'm actually hoping it would be too much to hope that they're commercially friendly, but commercially...
They're written by politicians and civil servants, so...
Yes, give it up. I can't even finish the phrase, right? They're not going to be commercially anything.
For the record, let me say I was a politician. I was a civil servant. I have nothing against them, but only working in the business community, I realize what a different role that is.
It really is.
Yes.
And I mean, it's not a role that is unique to politicians going in-house, although you don't see a lot of politicians go in-house. But it's also not unique to outside attorneys going in-house. It's almost the same thing as the outside, as mm-hmm. any advisor to a company. You get to play the role of, you know, God, I dictate this is what you shall do.
Or devil's advocate.
And then you go in, there you go. And then you go in-house and realize you never have any clue what they actually did with your advice and how they operationalized it or how they acted upon it or what their ultimate decision was. All you know is what you told them to do. So it's usually a pretty awakening moment when people go in-house and watch, you know, how things are made. But it's the same thing in politics, watching laws get made. It's not pretty easy.
What is important for our listeners is that if the draft standard contractual clauses are published, to take a look at them because they will be open for consultation first. So you have a chance to respond. And that is a one-off because once the standard contractual clauses have been finalized and approved by the European Commission at the end of the year, you'll have to work with them as is. If you consider them to be unworkable, that this is your time to say so. From late September, probably for about a month, you'll have the time to share your views and provide input before the standard contractual clauses 2.0 are finalized.
Yes, and we'll actually take an opportunity on one of the podcasts, it won't matter who the guest is because it'll be a privacy person, to discuss the proposed standard contractual clauses.
I'm sure we will.
And trust me, TrustArc will probably submit comments on them and we'll review them. So you're always welcome to send us your comments or what your concerns might be or stay up to date with us. But we promise you, we will speak about them on a podcast and show you what our concerns with them might be.
Do you know what for consultation, Kate?
What?
The EDPB guidelines on controller processor. They have also been released.
Yes, I read those. A little dense, a little heavy.
Yes, but with lots of examples and what I really like, flowcharts. That's in the document.
Yes, we will give you the links to that as well. Just warning, it is a pretty heavy read, but it's really good information.
It is good information, and this update was overdue for some time. It is a major update of the original Working Party 29 guidelines on the controller processor concepts that were published in 2010. And I believe those were written, if not completely, at least to a large extent by Peter Hustings, who many still see as one of the godfathers of privacy, at least here in Europe. But this is the update of those guidelines also to bring them in line with GDPR. And when I say bring them in line with GDPR, I'm being unkind because basically, the concepts haven't changed. I mean, a controller under the regulation is the same as a controller under the directive was. But the examples are more up to date. The context is more aligned with GDPR. So from that perspective, the opinion is indeed more in line with GDPR. Of course, recent case law has been taken into account, like the Fashion ID case and the Verbraucherzentrale and some of the others. And that is what you will all see throughout the document. And lots of examples that I really like. But also here, if there are examples that you are missing, if there are scenarios that you are missing, this is the time you have until October 19 to submit your views and your ideas to the European Data Protection Board. Because if there is a controller processor, joint controller situation where you are struggling with, am I controller, am I processor, and this opinion doesn't help you with the answer to your questions, now is the time to maybe get an answer from the European Data Protection Board.
Yeah, and we actually have some clients. I won't name exactly who they are, but they are, you don't call them multi-level marketing anymore, consumer sales, people that are selling the product themselves, like the historical Avon. And there's lots and lots of these companies out there now, and it's very, very difficult to determine who's the controller and who's the processor when the individual selling the products should be the controller because they're a business, they are not an employee, and they are selling the products as their business, but yet they're individuals who have very little knowledge or sophistication or maturity or awareness of privacy laws or data transfer or anything along that line. And so that's a very complicated example that I do not believe that the guidance spoke to at all. I didn't read it for that example to begin with, but that might be one that we can submit and ask for some clarification. But of course, there may be companies that don't want clarification on it because then they might have to change what they've decided it is.
That's also always part of the conversations. One of the questions I still have after reading the draft opinion or this version of the opinion is related to processors, because the board makes very clear now that processors are always a separate entity. But it is not so clear, they don't address whether that also needs to be a separate legal entity. Could it also be an operational entity that is still part of the same legal entity? And that is something that I would like to see a bit more clarity on. One of the things that they do explain is that it could, for example, be if you have a group of companies that you can have a joint service center acting as a processor on your behalf. But whether it always needs to be a separate legal entity is not yet clear from the opinion.
Right. I didn't pick up on that in reading it, but that was really interesting. And I'm with you. I agree that having the examples were wonderful. I was looking for one of the examples that I really liked, and I think I found it. On page 21, it talks about research projects, and then later, just a little bit further down from there, talks about clinical trials. And I absolutely love those examples. My background is in healthcare, and so that's something that I wrestled with a lot. But another one was headhunters. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you the number of times that I've gotten questions from other privacy professionals or companies about headhunters and how the data can be shared and where the headhunters or the headhunting agencies pull their data from and different things along that line. So I loved seeing that example.
Yeah, I like the example on the law firm. I don't have the pages in front of me, but this is part of the discussion in the opinion that not all processing activities involving multiple parties are always joint controllership or always controller to processor relationships. Sometimes it's just a controller and a controller processing the same data for different purposes, both
for their own purposes.
And that is the case with a law firm. That is the example being used. Yes, if a law firm acts on your behalf as a company, then you may transfer personal data to them. But it is not their main purpose to process the personal data. The data is just used as part of their purpose, namely to represent the client. So that would just be a controller-to-controller relationship.
Page 12.
Well, there you go. So yes, it is dense for sure, but it's...
I'm looking to see how many pages are there total.
48 pages.
And the flow charts that Paul loves are towards the end. but they're very, very good. So it's really, really good read. It's a really heavy read, but it's very, very informative. I don't think it goes as far as what people here in the U.S. may have questions about, or people outside Europe, heck, people in Europe, may have questions about. So if you have time and you're interested, please go read it, because as Paul said, you have an opportunity to ask more questions. And actually, I believe very strongly that companies, especially when it comes to data protection, privacy, information governance, whatever you want to call it, information governance is much, much broader than privacy. Let me put that caveat out there. But I believe that when you're working in that role, you need to build a relationship with the regulators. Whether you make them your friends, whether you can take them out to coffee and they have to pay for their own, whatever, get to know your regulators before something bad happens, because you want to be able to take them out to coffee and go, hypothetically, if this was to happen, which is much better often than making an official inquiry.
Not the response to such hypotheticals, but...
Exactly, but they might. Same. Depends on what the relationship is. I have to admit that one of my favorite regulators happened to be my investigator when I was with the company. We lost one of the first unencrypted laptops when HITECH went into effect in the U.S. So breach notification, we lost. I thought for a while we were the first, but I can go back and look at it and tell we're not. We were investigated for probably over a year because of it. Turns out some of the policies had some outdated language in it, which made the investigation last longer. Do not reference specific technology in your policies. And so when I say become friends with your regulators, I actually mean make them your friends. You never know where that relationship might go. So I know we...
I'm very lucky to still have lots of friends in the regulatory community.
Yes.
From when I still worked there. And some people I just haven't lost touch with.
We love that about you, Paul. We really love that about you. You bring a lot of that expertise with you, but having those connections is huge. So with the last little bit that we have left, should we talk a little bit about the LGPD in Brazil?
Sure, let's move out of Europe. I mean... there is more to the world than just Europe, as Annalise told us a few weeks ago.
Say it's not so. Actually, 3 years ago this week, I was in Europe. The only time that I've been in Europe. So 3 years ago this week, I was in Europe. We stayed mainly in London, in Richmond, outside London. But yes, I took the trains. What do you call them?
Eurostar.
Are they just trains?
Yeah. High-speed trains.
I took those in. All over London.
Oh, the tube, you mean. The metro. Yes,
the blue line, I think it was. And so the whole mind the gap thing, and took the fast train over to Paris and had a couple of days in Paris. Oh, it was fantastic. Loved it. So,
well, you're always welcome back in Europe.
My only trip to Europe.
Once COVID, huh? You're always welcome back in Europe once COVID is over. Borders are still closed for now.
I love.
So yeah, let's move to Brazil, because in a very surprise move, overnight, suddenly the LGPD was sort of in force. We still don't know exactly what the status is, but it was supposed to be postponed until early next year or late December. And then suddenly the Senate said, oh no, not on our watch, that's not going to happen. And said, it applies as of more or less now.
Bam, thank you. It was, and we had a podcast on Brazil. I'm looking to see when that was. Earlier in this, which was really interesting. Let me see if I can find that. We'll link to it and let you know in there. But the conversation with the gentleman that we were talking to was very much up in the air. Yeah, so-and-so is approved, so-and-so is not approved. Are we going to have a DPA? We don't know. It's not been staffed. Well, even if Congress approves it, the governor will. Enforcement will be delayed. It won't. Nobody really knew. And then all of a sudden we woke up and it'd been passed.
Yes. Well, as of September 10, it is not officially in force yet, because the bill against which the Senate, the bill that was supposed to postpone the entry into of the LG until next year, the Senate took out the related to DD, but the bill itself still was adopted. And that now has to be approved or vetoed by the president of Brazil. And that hasn't happened yet, which means that the earlier decision
could see the wheels turning in your head as I'm watching you right now. It's like it's a fascinating to watch this.
It is very complex, and this is well, you talked about making legislation before that isn't pretty. This is one of the worst examples on legislation not being pretty, but it is for the greater good. So by September 7th, the president will need to take a decision on to that law. The assumption is he doesn't, and that means that once he signs the law, the LGPD would to force either from that or from 16 August.
Written and passed is that the enforcement can begin immediately, but the penalties would be deferred to a future date.
Yes, that's true. And what we also know by now is that the protection authority, the ANPD, has been established, because at the same day that the Senate said, no, we're not going, the president signed the establishing the data protection authority. Debate is now ongoing on who should be chair of the data protection authority. Some names are on Twitter earlier today. And once that is done, then also the DPA can start its work. And that is pretty relevant, because there are lots of guidelines that are required, also implementing guidelines under the LGPD, for example, to appoint a data protection officer when data protection impact assessments. And those are left to the data authority. So we hope that they will be quick in being established, but also quick.
Yeah, and I believe, are we publishing this podcast on the 15th or the 22nd? On the 15th. Okay. We usually publish pretty quickly. I believe it's the next day. So if this comes out on the 15th, it's going to be the next day we actually have a webinar with TrustArc where Paul is speaking on the LGPD. And so that ought to be pretty interesting. We rarely do advertising, but I'm going to do that. So if you're listening to this on the 15th, tune in tomorrow.
And otherwise, watch the recording.
We'll have a webinar on it, and that should be pretty fascinating. Paul is on that. Exactly. The recording will always be there for free download. Go look at that.
It's in any case, Christina Frechko from our research team, and maybe a guest from Brazil if we can make the calendars align. So yes, that's the webinar that's forthcoming. We're also updating all our resources on the LGPD. A accountability handbook will be available shortly, and all the updates in the software and all of that is being worked on behind the scenes as well. Because also we were taken a bit by surprise. Nobody expected this to happen overnight.
Yes, right?
So we prioritized foolishly everything to do with EU-US relations, and then suddenly Brazil was there as well.
So quickly, before we come to an end, we should point out that as much as people believe that the LGPD is essentially the GDPR adopted word for word, it's not. There are some key differences. And you need to be aware that there are key differences. So I have a couple up here in front of me. Paul, you may have some others in mind, but one of them is what data is protected. So the LGPD does not detail the information it refers to, which makes it very, very broad. It doesn't include anonymized data. LGPD does make an exception for the behavior profiling of a natural person if that person is identified. And then there is, I don't believe that the LGPD actually addresses pseudonymization at all. I think the concept is there, but the specific recognition of a mechanism, pseudonymization, is not there. There's some other key differences as well. Did you have some top of mind?
Well, the main one, and that's also one of the more serious, is the deadline for dealing with individual requests. Because the deadline for simple responses is immediately, so no time at all. And that is if you would ask, tell me about your policies and what is happening with my data in general. So where you can refer to a policy, you need to respond straight away. If it is a more detailed request, so if it also involves getting access to the individual's data and giving them a copy, you have 15 days. That's not 15 business days. That's 15 days. So that's about, which is...
The LGPD requires controllers to appoint a DPO. I do not believe that process appoint a DPO.
No, but that will be limited by the ANPD once...
There's some other differences in here. The penalties, I think, under the LGPD are less.
Mm.
But of course, as we were talking... I think it's 2%.
It is 2%, or I think it's 2.5 million reais, which I believe is around $60,000. There is a whichever is higher, but more interestingly, let me just look up the amount. It's 50 million reais or 9 million US dollars. And indeed, it's 2% or whichever is higher. But in more serious situations, that maximum of 50 million reais could be a daily fine.
Without any limit.
Without any limit. So then you could have a sanction of $9 million or 2% of turnover per day that you are in contravention of the law. And then suddenly it starts to count.
No idea if the Brazilian regulators or enforcement activities are really practical, which is one of the things that I love about the EU. So we have no idea what's coming from the enforcement agency since it's brand new. But I believe that the LED, their extraterritorial reach is a little different in that the GDPR is for organizations, whether they're established in the EU or not, but they monitor behavior of individuals in the EU. The LGPD does not have that. LGPD will also not apply to data flows that originate outside of Brazil and are merely transmitted but not further processed in the country. So it's actually less territorial.
True. At the same time, as soon as personal data from people in Brazil is processed, and especially if goods or services are targeted at Brazilians, then the law applies. So maybe there are some slight differences there, but I wouldn't rest on my laurels if I were a company doing business in Brazil. You better get started because there is a lot of work to be done. And even though there is still a lot unclear about how to comply with the LGPD, it will take you time to get the work done. And yes, you can leverage a lot of the work you've done for CCPA and for the GDPR and for other privacy laws, but you still need to find that delta, what is different for you specifically, and start working on it. And let's not forget, once the law applies, it applies. There is no two-year transition period here. The only thing that is not possible before August 21 is issuing a sanction penalty. But the DPA could, for example, already say, give a warning if you are non-compliant.
Absolutely. So I think that kind of brings us to the end of our conversations for today. It's been fascinating. I love it when you and I actually have a opportunity just to sit and discuss some of the things that have happened in the privacy world because they move so fast. Sometimes we wake up and bam, something new has happened. That is pretty unusual. And today we talked about quite a few that were pretty unusual.
Absolutely. And more to come. As promised, next week we'll be back with you with a guest. Interesting conversation because we have already recorded it, so we know it is an interesting conversation. And we have some very nice episode lined up for you for future shows. If you like the podcast, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustart.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy, and until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.